Hey guys, welcome back to the Dark Real Talk podcast. My name is Agnieszka Janarek and I'm a founder of Trumblog. My guest today is Ryan O'Donnell, aka Ryan O, and the topic we discussed is something many of you find interesting, something you ask us multiple times to cover. We talked about what exactly is ABA, what stands behind these three letters. Applied behavior analysis. We geeked into this topic very thoroughly, so make sure you listen. Make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel to always be on time with new episodes. I hope you will enjoy the episode. Make sure you let us know what you think.
Thank you, Ryan, for accepting the invitation and joining me today in the Dark Real Talk program.
Thank you. Super excited.
I want to talk about what is ABA, and for the first time, if a person hears ABA, what they should know.
All right. So there's two things that were kind of that come to mind here. We're known a lot for early intervention, helping children with autism-related diagnoses, and a lot of the things that you find on the internet are circulated or are centered around that. But the larger ABA is really exciting because at the end of the day, it's just trying to help people through natural science sort of way, help solve socially significant problems. So there's a whole lot of different applications that are really fun to get into. And there's some like core things that you'll consistently see in them. And I think the biggest take home for anybody is we're helping solve things that are important to those people. And it should work. We should understand why it works. And we should be able to replicate that as well. So I don't know, we could dive into maybe one specific area. We could dive into the history.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think because when people hear we help people with to achieve significant outcomes, what does it mean? I mean, can we go there and tell what it is exactly that you do?
Yeah, for sure. So I can start with a couple examples. So we talked about autism therapy being one. So for that one to highlight and start there, the goal is to help people overcome skill deficits and build their skills and really motivate people to achieve what it is that they want to achieve. So early intervention typically looks like children have some sort of makeup, some sort of like amount of skills that they're kind of behind that we're trying to help them make up. So that they can live whatever meaningful, valued life it is that they want to live. Looks like early skill set development of making eye contact, speaking your first words, how do you make social engagement valuable to somebody. But that starts to shift across the lifespan into what are the goals that they want to achieve? How do we work on those sort of goals? So that's one area application. Another one that's really completely, totally different, but in the same vein is there was a company called Mammacare that was really interested in how do we help women self-identify breast lumps that may be cancerous. And this was done largely in the 70s and 80s. And what was really cool is the perceived limit of what is believed to be identifiable from just like the touch of your finger was supposed to be somewhere around like the size of an eraser, roughly. And it turned out to be a pretty challenging thing to be able to do because the idea is that early identification requires identifying things that are as small as like a pin tip. So you have to be very good identifying those as well as identifying the difference between fatty tissue and actually potentially cancerous lumps. And so over a very long period of time, they slowly refined on the research of how do we do these sort of things. They turned that into this thing that you can grab off the shelf, $35, $50 tool to go out and coach you through how to identify those things. So that was delivered as well as a training module for people that are nurse practitioners and such. And they've been slowly working on getting that out there. So the goal there is, how do we help people identify potentially dangerous situations in a very easy way that we can repeat? We know why it works, right? And that typically is the training process. Like we really dive into what are the specific steps that need to be taught, trained, and we make sure that those work very well. So that Mamacare company is now like piloting in the state of Georgia in the United States, with all their healthcare clinics, and trying to get that out there, because the actual, it's actually doing better than some other methods. It's not the only method. And it's not like replacing any other screening, screening activities, but it is a great additional tool that's helping people catch and identify potentially dangerous cancerous lumps before other methods would have been caught. So it, you can see the pretty stark difference between autism therapy and identifying.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Because often people consider ABA, when they hear, when they learn something about the ABA, they often consider it like, okay, so this is for children with disabilities or with people with special needs. And that's it. You don't use it anywhere else, which is not true.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really just a science of helping people understand how to achieve what they're trying to achieve in life, I'd say. It's meant to be very broad because there's basic principles that stay consistent. I'm sure you talked about them on this podcast to some extent, you know, the idea of reinforcement or the idea of stimulus control, which I usually describe through cues. Like, how do we get the appropriate cues to trigger certain behavioral patterns? Like, those things hold consistent when you understand the science that is applied behavior analysis. But it can take so many different forms. That's one of the reasons I got so excited and so into the field, is there's so many potential opportunities out there.
Absolutely, because basically we can even say that we use principles of ABA even if we don't really know about it. I mean, we still use them in everyday life.
Yeah, it's this interesting, interesting kind of angle to think about how everybody... Everybody is interested in understanding why people do what they do, generally. But when you have this framework, right, of what it is, like how it actually works, I think it it just, it gives you a different picture, makes a little bit more sense. It's really cool. It's been a very, I don't like try to preach and sell it, but it's been a very cool perspective to be able to understand why people do what they do. And I think so many people are interested in, you know, why did my husband say this? Why did my girlfriend say this? Why is that presidential candidate doing X, Y, or Z? And it gives you perspective and a different lens to look at.
Yes. And gives you, yeah, it gives you some understanding often, and makes you even more, can we say compassionate about the other person?
Yes. Yeah. That's a great point. I think the biggest thing it's done to help me out, a good one would be like social media, like something's commented and you're, you know, you're upset about something like that, right? Having an understanding of why someone may post that, does that, it kind of gives you that step back of like, this isn't that person. It's not their fault. There are certain circumstances, certain reasons that these things happen. That's not to discredit, you know, anybody's autonomy and feel of like self-worth, but it gives you an understanding of like why these things might happen, which is, I think, the first step to being able to kind of take a breath and figure out how to approach certain situations with anybody.
Absolutely. And what can we say? Because when we think, when we say ABA, we say applied behavior analysis. So the main interest of this science is behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So behavior, that's a great question. Behavior for us is anything that's, any living thing does. And again, it's super broad and it's very large. But the idea here, again, is that we need to start with something that kind of holds true across everything that people do. So behavior typically is things that are observable and measurable.
Yeah.
And there becomes this kind of weird line of what is observable, and we're talking about, like, say, your thoughts. But the idea is that your thoughts are observable, maybe only to you. You can look at those sort of things. They are countable in that sense, and we could try to understand them. Mm-hmm. It's just there's this buffer between, I'm going to have to use my words to be able to understand what is you understand about your own behavior. But all of that holds true. And this could be, again, it could be the child that is diagnosed with autism. It could be the parent of the child and their behavior. It could be the behavior of, like I said, any living thing. So there's a lot of work in ecology, zoology, and those sort of applications. Trying to identify a good animal example is the country, the country of Mozambique. There was a civil war that laid a lot of different repercussions afterwards, including landmines all the way up into educational settings. Like schools had landmines in them. And the question become, how do you eradicate these? It takes, I want to say it's somewhere around about a day for a human. It's about a day for a human to look and make sure that there is nothing in an area about the size of a tennis court. So when you start to talk about trying to cover a country and eradicate mines.
And the danger.
The danger is the socially significant part. The time frame of humans looking at trying to solve this through conventional methods and going through metal detectors, like that wasn't going to be fast enough. Mm-hmm. And with some of our basic research, we know that animals, including rats, are very sensitive to smells. So they're able to teach them to discriminate certain smells that are only in those landmines, mm-hmm. the specific explosives used. They're not heavy enough. Like they are light enough mm-hmm. of a creature that they're not going to actually make the landmines explode.
All right.
So they were able to teach these rats that were once observed to be very, rodents, not needed, not part of, like nothing useful were coming from them, to actually being very beneficial. So that is called, now a company, a movement is totally eradicated in some countries, including Mozambique. A few different it's totally eradicated and lost my train of thought there. Give me a quick sec. It's totally eradicated and freed the people really of that danger because they were able to quickly train and deploy these rats to help identify where the humans should step in to demine the areas. So, yeah, to reel it back there, behavior could be anything, any living organism, essentially. We're really particularly interested in human situations, but that is not the only place. And obviously, you can work between human and non-human, like in those examples, and solve some really cool socially significant issues and make the world a better place.
Absolutely, yes. And I think what you said, that they train rats, and I think that there is a website, even it's called Hero Rats. When they Hero Rats are the rats that search for landmines, and they use, this is a great example because they use all the learning principles, right? The ABA principles to teach it, and they also achieve very socially significant outcome, as you mentioned. So it's like the perfect example, actually.
Yeah, it's really cool. We call those things a behavioral technology. When you kind of figure out the process and how to do it, and then you pair it with whatever technology, tools, apps, and whatever, and kind of make it something that can be repeated and, you know, over and over and over again.
Behavior is, in this example, it will be behavior both of a rat trainer, so humans that were training those rats to search, and also rats, because behavior principles, the learning principles, they apply no matter if you are a rat or a human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which sounds a little weird sometimes at first, like when you hear, like, what do we share, you know, with rats? But the thing is there's some things that we do share, there's other things that we don't. Language is pretty much the biggest differentiator there, that it's argued is language is what allows us to have, you know, these, the ability to communicate as effectively as we do, be able to plan, analyze, be able to build cities, like everything socially. Not that we don't see basic parts of that going on with communication in animals, but that's kind of the biggest differentiator there. And if you can get past that, it becomes like, you know, us saying that we're similar to other animals. If you can get past that, there's a lot of beauty in my experience of, it's much more beautiful, I guess, and it's cool to understand those similarities than it is meant to ever be demeaning or anything like that.
Yes, absolutely. I think that the fact that we are learning in the same way, apart of course for some differences, as you mentioned, but the principles are the same, is actually making things much easier.
Yeah. And so in a sense, like what one person learns in, say, a research study on one side of the world with a, you know, human or non-human could be totally applicable in some ways on the totally other side of the world. So in a sense, like if we understand how to like what the limitations are and how, where we are similar with other animals, it allows us to just kind of build solutions a lot faster. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And often what I encountered with people when they say that they learn something about, usually they say it's behaviorism. They rarely say ABA. They use behaviorism. Is that sometimes they say that, oh, I don't like it because it doesn't take into credit. It just looks at the behavior. It makes me, you know, feel like a robot, for example.
Yeah.
It's not true, right?
No, not at all. So that kind of goes back to, if you look around on the internet and try to find things, there's a lot of misconceptions. Anybody can put out an opinion that's valuable, that, you know, it's cool to put out your opinions. But there's a lot of misunderstandings of our field that are publicly out there. And part of the reason I've got into things like podcasting that you're doing myself and video work is the parts of our field that, for the most part, most of the good things and the awesome things that our field are doing, they were only shared in academic journals, which is valuable and it's needed. But we are lacking a ton of information that's freely accessible about what we really do, what we really mean when we say ABA, or what we really mean when we say behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. Because people are, as you said, those are misconceptions on the internet, and people get a sense that you just use some laboratory methods and you just observe people in cages like with some animals, and this is not exactly how it works. As you said, it's like achieving, helping people achieve.
The early days was behavior modification. And behavior modification was rudimentary. I'm talking about the early 1930s to the 1970s, maybe. And a lot of what was understood then and what was practiced then, I would say almost all of it has left us, as like how we practice day to day. Those methods have shifted drastically. What happened kind of politically was cognitive behavioral therapy came about because of our own insufficiencies of being able to really understand some really tricky mental health conditions. And that sort of politics of behavior modification and not really meeting the demand of people's needs and the mental health conditions led rise to CBT and kind of helped fuel CBT approaches. But it's kind of now coming back around. It's very interesting. The work of a few different key people have led to this whole new kind of third wave of cognitive behavioral therapy, like they talk about, where we're taking the goodness of what we understand from ABA, from behaviorism, and we're kind of blending it back in all together, and we're figuring out where those really overlap.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So this is because, this is great. And I think people need, I mean, your podcast and the work that is done on social media about ABA, it's really helping because people get to know it, not from this, you know, laboratory side, and get to understand that this can be helpful also in your daily life. And I think that what we miss very often is, for me, it's school settings. That it would be so helpful if teachers had some access to ABA for learning. Yeah,
so that's one of the areas of application. It's been pretty significantly distributed in the United States under a term called positive behavior supports, and there's some differences there. There's some different acronyms, but the idea was early, like how, since we're so interested in teaching and understanding how we trigger certain behaviors, pro-social behaviors and like good behaviors for people, that led to people really studying and understanding, like, how do we really learn? How do we teach people certain subjects? And it's kind of branched off this whole different area called instructional design, which there was a lot of really good work and pioneers understanding how do we teach and instruct. That led to a couple different applications. One is direct instruction. Another is precision teaching. Mm-hmm. There's different models that have been implemented here in the United States. One is CABIS, Comprehensive Application of Behavior Analysis in Schools. And all of these have been demonstrated on various different levels of their effectiveness. The problem then becomes of how do you pitch it? How do you describe it? How do you actually build it into like a school climate or infrastructure? I know education in the US, there's so many different people, so many different theories, ideas out there that in a way you're kind of competing to get yours heard. Mm-hmm. And particularly in the US, it's very much a, we're going to do things when things are bad rather than a very preventative approach. Right. A lot of what behavior analysis has found is how to teach super effectively and how to do it well. And it requires a lot of ownership of the teacher is responsible for really curating a lot of the outcomes. And it's not really built into the US's culture. Mm-hmm. So it's been tricky.
All right. Yeah.
It's so effective, but getting people to kind of take that step and try it out is difficult because it's not taught, at least in the US, in educational programs. It's kind of like telling people after the fact, like, hey, we have this really effective thing, but it's nothing you've heard of before.
Something completely different for what you know.
Like, you did your master's degree, your PhD, awesome. Now learn this. There's some errors there, I think, in how we need to fix that.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I think, can we say that ABA and anything that is around it is also focused on what you said about how we all learn and how we can, it's actually the science of learning, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a fair way to put it. The science of learning, the science of motivation sometimes is a good one to add there as well. As a good example, you can have like you're in the States, you have like your C or D students, your folks that are struggling. It may be that there's a mild learning disability. It may be they aren't motivated. It could be for a number of reasons, right? There's an application there where they use this thing that I talked about called precision teaching. It's really simple. Just kind of pinpointing things that you want to work on. It's typically in this academic role. When I say academics, reading, writing, math, comprehension, those sort of things. And the goal here is to help those students overcome, you know, the deficits that they have, maybe the hesitancies that they have, the uncertainties they have about, like, are they really confident, you know, and help them build that confidence to approach different subjects. And they've been able, over years of research now, to develop a model to where an entire grade, like, all of, let's say, fifth grade math can be taught in 40 hours of instruction, which is unreal. Like, now this isn't like you're going in for 40 hours in 1 week and bam, you've learned all fifth grade math. It is spaced out over time, but it's pretty still crazy. Like, they can spend a quarter, what we'd have is a quarter, you know, 9 weeks of instruction time, and they can, in 40 hours in those, you know, 3 months, be able to teach this entire subject. And the crazy thing is, it's not drill and kill. It's not like the children don't like it. They come out smiling, loving it, confident. And these things are actually growing very rapidly in the last couple of years. These centers that are, in a way, kind of like a tutoring center. That's one way that our field's trying to show, like, if you do these things proactively, you know, and even reactively, I guess, in like a CD student, but if you try to do them in a very systematic, carried out way, you can have extremely effective outcomes. And these are repeated time and time and time and time again. There's schools that give money back guarantees that you will learn what you need to learn in that time, which is kind of crazy. And I know, at least in the States, if you were to ask any of our school districts to offer a money back guarantee, that would not happen. It would not happen. And it's essentially that we understand the basic learning principles, that is our science of understanding learning, motivation. And then we're very meticulous with, like, what is the process? Like, how does learning occur? What steps do we need to take? We break that down And then we carry that out through a few different ways, either one-on-one working with people, mm-hmm. like a tutoring setting. There are some models of three or four students at the same time going together. And then like direct instruction I mentioned is capitalizing on how do you do that in a school setting where you have 20, 30, 40, 50 students in a classroom as well. So there's a lot of materials and resources out there. Again, they're not publicly available or they're not publicly known and widespread, but people like ourselves know them and can point people out for them all the time.
Yeah, but what you said is amazing, like 40 hours and how fast and how efficient it is. And yeah. It's so great because it really shows that if we learn how we learn, we can really be much more effective in what we do. Because basically, when we look into our life, every step is actually learning something. Whatever we do, we learn. It doesn't mean school. It's not only school and college that is learning. It's everything you do in life, you learn. It can be a physical activity, anything. And the rules apply to all of it.
You mentioned how you can help yourself. So on that topic, that's one of the reasons I got so into it. It was immediately useful for me in understanding why I was doing what I was doing, how to kind of pursue my own goals, values, dreams, ambitions, and such. Some examples, like understanding what conditions that I do best when it comes to like physical activity, going to the gym, like when do I need to do those? Like I know if I want to be kind of operating at my prime and my efficiency, my happiness levels, socially and those sort of things. Like I need to get my butt out of bed early. I need to go to the gym at like 5 a.m. I do not like waking up that early, but if I do those things, I can get everything in. It kind of sets my day correct. And such. And like, that was through understanding my own behavior and how I kind of go about, understand my behavior. I've done that in a bunch of different ways. Like one is I was very interested in how do we start getting this stuff out to other people. So talked about blogs, podcasting, video conferences. Like for the last 4 years, I've used the own science to be able to understand like how do we do more of these things, how do we put these things out. And it's all through the use of looking at my own behavior through a behavior analytic lens. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it sounds really awesome. And it's really, I think it can help. I mean, it can help anyone. And do you think you have to be a professional with a degree, academic degree, to start getting into ABU world, to understand it?
That's an interesting question. My upfront answer is no. My professional one will be like, there's some more after that. But definitely no, like anybody can go out there and read and like discover what's going on between blogs, books. Most of our stuff is written in books, most of it in English. It is a problem. It is not the only format. As part of kind of my life mission is to translate and like work on getting that into different mediums. But yeah, anybody can go out and find, maybe we should get a couple books to recommend.
Yeah, I think so. It would be perfect. Yeah. And I will later add links to the people so they can.
Yeah. The one that I'm a really big fan of as a starting point, and this is for somebody, it kind of depends on what you're getting into. Like, are you wanting to understand how this might work in your own happiness and your own life? Like that might be something where you go into like this area called acceptance and commitment therapy, where they talk about how it is that you can kind of understand those sort of things. If you're wanting to really understand maybe like the whole side of ABA, then there's a Science of Consequences by Susan Snyder. That's a really good starting point.
Yeah.
It will get a little more technical, but not too much. And it's like, if you want to make it more technical, you can do that. If you want to chase those more technical things, you can. And then what else? There's one that's called the Nurture Effect, which really highlights like how this has benefited communities. Some of the schools that we've talked about and those sort of things by Anthony Biglin. So there's different routes to go there. But the other side of that is if you're wanting to professionally do this and really help people out, basically what happens is we try to practice and be as ethically and morally sound as possible. So there's a certification process. People can go and get up to a master's or a PhD in this. And you can get your certification if you wanted to go that route. And the idea there is that we're helping really protect the consumers of ABA. And that's why that's there. So We have our own behavior analyst certification board. It is nationally, although it's really based in the U.S. and they work with other countries that are open to those sort of things. And in the States, we have a whole other layer called licensure, which is by our state. And the licensures really define what it is that I can and can't do as a behavior analyst. Where are the lines between this is a behavior analyst versus a social worker versus a clinical psychologist? And those all vary a little bit. So I usually tell people, like, definitely go out there, learn. You can understand how to use it in your own life. When it comes to helping others, that's where it starts to become more of a formal process where you got to decide really what you want to do with it and what are the steps where you're at to be able to do that.
But so if you want to learn where it all started, so where are the roots of ABA?
So the roots, early 1900s is where we started. There was a guy, John B. Watson, and then another one after that that is definitely really famous as well, B.F. Skinner. Those are kind of the pioneers of behaviorism. Skinner's largely credited with that. He's got a whole lot of books. He was known for being controversial, especially at the time. He's an academic writer. Like, everything in our field is academic writers first. So it's not like a narrative where you pick it up and you're totally consumed in it. It's not, you know, a Harry Potter. It's not a Jodi Picoult book, you know. So people need to go into that expecting, like, I'm going to read something that is more academic. But our roots are in that. Our roots are in the laboratory working with animals. And I don't know, how far do you want to go there? Like, do you have specific questions in the roots?
I think because people often know Skinner, at least they know that in my professional work, I mean, in dog training, in animal training world, people are often interested. I mean, they heard about Skinner, but what they know is just positive and reinforcement and punishment, and that's it. This is the whole picture they have of what Skinner did and what behaviorism is, because they are often connected to ABA.
I don't remember the exact number, but there was something around like 500,000 studies or something like that. And like data sessions that went into some of the books that he wrote. So the first thing is people will sometimes read and consume just like a paragraph, a sentence, a quote, a book of his. But it's so much more than that. And there's so much that went into it. It's amazing. Some of the things that we hear about him, you know, positive reinforcement, punishment, those sort of things are publicly known. But there was really, I would say, two sides to Skinner. There was, what do we know? And he would research those sort of things and really start to refine, like, this is what we know about influencing behavior. Something like positive reinforcement will always lead to a much more proactive and a better solution when we're using positive reinforcement over anything else. That could be punishment techniques, that could be any sort of what we call extinction or negative reinforcement. Like, it is going to be better when we do that. But he was also known for extrapolating and kind of imagining, like, where could this go? So for example, he was being very speculative, very speculative in where could this benefit and help, like in education, for example. And a lot of what he was critiqued for was for his work where he was trying to, you know, say what would be the possibilities of something. So, for example, one that he was critiqued for quite a bit was reimagining how people could go about like child rearing and raising their children. Like, what are some things that you could possibly do that would leverage off of what we understand about the science of learning to be able to help children out? And if you believe that children should be able to go out and run around and do their own thing and just kind of like explore the world on their own versus something that's a little more structured, which is what he would suggest, then that's where he would be typically misunderstood and kind of taken out of context. So there's a lot more to his work than what's usually out there. Because usually what I tell people,
and
it's a speculative work where he was saying, you know, how would we apply this to a culture, to a government? One one of them was freedom. Like he was critiquing, like, if we understand why we're influenced, are we really free? Or is it that we just have a better understanding of our influences now? Mm-hmm. So he wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, where he was purposely, I think, very abrasive and saying, like, you don't have freedom. It's that your behavior is controlled by all these different circumstances. And that doesn't sound good, right? And I don't think he was totally right. And, like, we do understand sources that influence our behavior, but it doesn't really make sense. We did a whole podcast episode on this, talking about, like, if are you free or not? Where does it doesn't, I don't really matter at the end of the day. It's, do you want to understand the influences of your behavior? If yes, then you can take a lens like behavior analysis and understand it better and work on achieving your goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. But I think also with Skinner, would you say that reading some of his books may be helpful and could be a good actually start for someone?
Yeah, for sure.
Which Skinner book?
Yes. Science and Human Behavior. Mm-hmm. I think is the one that typically resonates the most with everybody. And that one is, it was written as a course that you would go through in, like, undergraduate. You kind of read a chapter a week and go through and discuss those sort of things. It will talk about everything from where it began, some of the research that he was conducting at the time, why punishment was, you know, talked about and being, like, why it was not preferred over reinforcement. Mm-hmm. There's whole chapters on those sort of things. There's chapters on government implications, like, all over the place, your own self-management, etc. If people are wanting something that's kind of fun and a different read, mm-hmm. he wrote a book called Walden 2 that kind of talks about a utopian future and why, mm-hmm. how you can kind of build off of our science something that might be a different type of society in future. And he's I don't mean this in a bad way, but I think he's a horrible narrative writer. but compared to others that we're used to. But mm-hmm. Going into it, knowing that that is going to be an amazing story and implications, but it might not be your perfectly made up fantasy world. That's not what he was about. He was about, you know, sharing the possibilities of it. I don't know. Do you have any particulars that you were really fond of?
I think that you mentioned The Science of Consequences, which I think is a great one to start for people. But with other books, I was thinking about, what would you say about Paul Chan's and Learning and Behavior?
Yeah, Learning and Behavior is a good one. I read that 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't remember the exact details of it as much. But Paul Chance was a great starting point. I would say
it was accessible, I think. It is.
Yeah. No, it's definitely accessible. I would say if you wanted to take a whack at, like, accessible to The Science of Consequences seems, with Susan Snyder, seems like your most accessible. Paul Chance is, and then Skinner. Skinner's is definitely a little bit more of a commitment. And everyone needs to remember a lot of Skinner's works were written so long ago that, you know, some of the times the examples he wrote about were relevant then. So if you're going back in time, you know, 40, 60, 70 years, and you're going to read something, just remember.
Not now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not happening now. Absolutely. So, and also, what resources on the internet? If someone wants to just watch some videos about ABA or listen to podcasts, which one?
Yeah, so, oh boy. For podcasts, one of the first gentlemen that really started it out, there was two folks. So Matt Sikoria has the Behavioral Observation Podcast, and he's doing interview style, talking about all sorts of topics. These are more technical. So if you're really into the technical professional side, you're going to get a lot more out of those discussions. There was a podcast called the Precision Teaching Podcast, which is a little trickier to find, but it was more on the education and those sort of 40-hour instruction outcomes that we were talking about. You can find some of those. Myself, for the shameless plug, myself and a gentleman named Abraham, there's a whole team now, but we started up a podcast called Why We Do What We Do. It's always my little joke to try to sling that into the podcast like I was doing earlier. And that was meant to be like a consumable psychology source. Mm-hmm. There's 83 episodes as of today. And they are spanning all the different, like, we've talked about each of the topics I kind of referenced here a little bit. Mm-hmm. it's meant to span a lot of different things. The one that we put out today was actually on dog breeds and their personalities.
Mm-hmm.
But we've talked about instructional design. We talked about precision teaching. There's a whole lot of stuff out there. And the goal is to talk about it in a very lay language, easily consumable mm-hmm. way. I make some videos. The videos are not super structured. I could give a couple examples of people that are doing things out there. So for video work, there is the BF Skinner Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
They put out a magazine. They also put out some videos if you want to like really dive into the historic Skinner recordings. There's a few people on YouTube. Myself, I run a channel called The Daily BA. The goal is to just share stories, relevance, behavior analysis. It's going to shift a little bit in 2019 into also sharing the story of a technology that I'm trying to build with some other people. So that'll be coming out on there. And a couple other folks, who else is doing video work? There is someone called PsychCore that really teaches the basics of things for people pursuing certification.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're really trying to understand a certain thing, PsychCore does that. And then Brett DeNovi is another that puts out content related to the field on YouTube. I think that's most of the folks that are doing things. I'm sure I forgot someone.
But there's plenty of resources, I think, for people if they want to go deeper and learn something. But can you tell, because you mentioned, I mean, the word came in psychology. And because people will struggle sometimes, I think. What's the difference between ABA and psychology?
Oh, man. So there's even a riff in our own field. I believe that that behavior analysis is studying psychological events. So we are looking at psychological events through behavior analytic lens. It is not the most popular perspective in our field. A lot of people say that we are separate from psychology and we are in totally our own thing. And I understand why we are so different in the way that we do things, that having that distinction is really useful. I'm a little bit more on, we are studying psychological events because it kind of brings us, since we are our own approach, our own philosophy, our own theory and such, like I think it just makes more sense for us to kind of be housed there. But yeah, if you ask somebody in our field or outside our field, we're usually talked about as being separate things. And it's okay to be separate fields in that sort of way, but like I still believe that we're trying to understand psychological events.
Okay.
Just in our own framework. Does that answer?
Yeah, I think so. Can we say that we try to, when we say, for example, that someone has some psychological condition, let's say someone is afraid of something. If we look mm-hmm. from ABE perspective, we would look at the behaviors and what's going from the observable possibility, what we can see and measure, and then we can call it fear.
Yeah. So the big difference there is a lot of mainstream psychology will mm-hmm. look at it as these sort of processes, right? Yeah. So like if you look at any, I don't know, syndrome or condition or brain process or anything like that, like there's a lot of these out there. Fear is a good one, how you're talking about, like any sort of like fear response or fear conditioning or anything that we may have could be looked at and measured in a few different ways. Oftentimes, cognitive approaches and psychological approaches are saying like they're really interested in that that bias that we may have or that fear response. But we take it a little bit of a different angle, saying what actually is being observably done during these. Mm-hmm. Remember, it could be private events and the things that only you can observe and feel yourself. And we're really taking it that extra step back to look at what were those things that maybe triggered people mm-hmm. saying like, I'm scared.
Yeah.
And that is a part of the equation mm-hmm. when it comes to helping people out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And cool. So it's not like we have to divide psychology and ABA and say, this one is better, this one is worse, because they just operate in a different lens. And we look into maybe the same thing, but... from a different perspective.
Yeah, if you're really interested in, if someone's really interested in psychology and behavior analysis blending very well, anything that comes from what they call contextual behavioral science. So there's an Association for Contextual Behavioral Science. That's kind of the home to go to first. That's a good starting point for anybody that's primarily in psychology that wants to learn a little bit about behavior analysis, I would say. It's been a very, very nice group that kind of blends the two together. And they're nice about it. they're very welcoming community, whereas we can have issues sometimes.
Yeah, that's like, I think in every field it happens.
Yeah.
So I think the people after the podcast, I will definitely list the resources you mentioned, but I think they will have like multiple places to go and start journey quite a lot. And I think that the main reason why we should at least try to get a little bit of ABA perspective is because it's so accessible and we use it every day. That if you just try to understand those basics, as you said, you will help yourself and this is, and maybe others. So
yeah,
even in your just a regular life, not being a professional.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't try to tell people like, hey, you got to check this out. you know, but one of, I think any perspective that you can take outside of the one that you currently have, that might be, you know, listeners, this might be like, you know, out now interested in behavior analysis, but if you can take different perspectives, it just makes the world a little bit easier to understand. ABA is one of those that have been extremely beneficial to me. And it's a journey I recommend. It's a slow journey, but if you want to like start to understand your own behavior, and you tackle that a little bit each day, it's very enlightening, I would say.
Yes, and it's there are so many things you can learn that it's hard to get away from it later when you start.
Yes, exactly. It's a lifelong commitment now.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Yes, for sure.
It was fun, and I think that it was, there's so much people right now can learn, and thank you for joining
me. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, very good questions. I love it. I'm super interested in following up on the podcast. Count me in to be a subscriber and a consumer of it. It's awesome work. I can't praise you enough. Like, the more people that are talking about this sort of stuff and putting it out there in easy ways to consume, like your podcast, the better the world's going to be at the end of the day. I know the work it takes to produce something, so my hat's off to you on, oh my gosh, like the video work. I spend 10 hours a day talking to myself and editing myself on a video and put it out there, and then you do it over and over again. So
yes, that's
keep it up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for listening to today's episode. Make sure you send us feedback, your thoughts, your comments, or maybe you have a topic in mind that you want us to cover in the future episodes. Also, make sure you check out Tromplo.com for upcoming courses. February is coming soon, and we have brand new courses with some new instructors, and I'm sure you will find something that fit your needs. So if you have any questions, make sure you just contact us or write an email, message us on Facebook, Instagram, or on YouTube. We are here to help. And make sure you check Tromplo.com.